Joy is like the rain, is it not? I come this morning as a person who spent some 16 years ministering in a United Methodist church. I became involved as a United Methodist in my early adulthood. And one of the things that I have valued about United Methodism is its stance on justice issues. People have spoken out for people that are oppressed for many long time and engaged in protest and changing law. They're in that process even yet, though they've not come all the way around on the issue to which I will speak today. So let it be heard from however you need to hear it. I wrote this message specifically for the context of people who were United Methodists, who I felt needed to hear stories that have been barred because of their particular stance on homosexuality. They're working on change, but they have a ways to go. So I read to you the story of the Ethiopian eunuch. This is from the book of Acts, which relates story after story of how people came to faith after Jesus' time. It is a story like many other stories where the unthinkable happens, a time of new grace and new inclusion. Later, God's angel spoke to Philip. At noon today, I want you to walk over to that desolate road that goes from Jerusalem to Gaza. He got up and went. He met an Ethiopian eunuch coming down the road. The eunuch had been on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem and was returning to Ethiopia, where he was the minister in charge of all the finances of Candace, queen of the Ethiopians. He was riding in a chariot and reading the prophet Isaiah. The Spirit told Philip, "Climb up into the chariot." Running alongside, Philip heard the eunuch reading from the book of Isaiah and asked, "Do you understand what you're reading?" And he answered, "How can I without help?" and invited Philip into the chariot with him. The passage that he read was, "As a sheep led to slaughter, and quiet as a lamb being sheared, he was silent and said nothing. He was mocked and put down, never got a fair trial." And the eunuch said, "Tell me, who is the prophet talking about, himself or someone else?" Philip grabbed the chance. Using this passage and this text, he spoke the good news of Jesus with him. As they continued down the road, they came to a stream of water. And the eunuch said, "Here is water. What is there to keep me from being baptized?" They both went down to the water, and Philip baptized him on the spot. When they came up out of the water, the Spirit of God suddenly took Philip off, and that was the last the eunuch saw of him. For he had gone down the road. He did not mind. He was happy as he could be. To understand that story, we have to understand just a little bit of the background of that text. This was a eunuch in those days, after people quit being hunters and gatherers and had developed an agrarian lifestyle. In this patriarchy, there was an understanding then of owning property and inheriting, passing it down through the generations. And so, people with money who had servants had those servants castrated, made to swear they could not procreate in order to protect the lineage and to make sure that the inheritance went where it was supposed to go. This eunuch was a person who understood the underside of life, who understood that as a eunuch, there were some places he just could not go, some things that he could just not do. For over the eons, a number of rules and laws and prescriptions and prohibitions had grown up around this less than status that the eunuch had, based on his sexuality and his inability to procreate. He was less than. There were places in the temple to which he could not go, even though he had become a proselyte and had gone on a pilgrimage. He could not go into certain places of the temple. There were places women could not go because of their sexual status as well. And then a number of prohibitions and prescriptions grew up around that, having to do with sexuality. I can't tell you what it would be like to have been a eunuch in those days. None of us can really get inside of his skin. But what I can tell you is about my own experience living as a lesbian, living as someone who has a less than status in this world, someone who cannot enjoy all the legal rights that come with marriage, one who cannot enjoy in certain denominations the right to be fully present and fully seen for who I am. That was my experience in the United Methodist Church. Oh, I had grown up in between the lines, and I had married, hoping to make that work, hoping to live part of the privileged heterosexual society, but found myself unable, found myself actually at the point after almost 25 years of marriage, recognizing that by stuffing my own authenticity, I was making myself ill, making myself sick, and that in fact, I was in danger of becoming mentally imbalanced for staying silent. While I was silent and while I was married, I could go before the board of ordained ministries in my church, go through seminary, go through all kinds of things that determine fitness for ministry and be interviewed and be found fit to be ordained in the United Methodist Church. And so I was. And suddenly, I was without that privilege. I knew that I needed to back away from the church and look deeply within to who I really was, so that I could live in that authenticity. I took a leave of absence from the church, and I met a woman some 2 years later, Jan. And we dated for a couple of years and partnered with one another. And yet there was still something inside of me that said that everything was not complete. There was still this call that I'd given so much of my life to. There was still this sense of spiritual leadership. Was my call invalid because of who I was living to be now? And so I talked it over with Jan, and we decided I would take another church. She said, to get it out of your system. I said, I don't think that's the way it works. And it was only a few months into that first year of serving this church, which was a number of miles away from my community where I lived. I hoped that I could live this part of my life over here somewhere and come back and live my life and my relationship separately. But on her way to work, one morning in March, she was killed in a traffic accident. And that was the moment in which I began to really understand what being closeted clergy meant for me. It had meant already that I worried about who was going to see me when I went out in public with my partner. Was it going to be one of my parishioners? Was it going to be someone who was another pastor and a colleague of mine? Somebody with whom I'd had acquaintances where I'd spoken? It's an awful feeling looking over my shoulder and wondering when something might happen, when someone might start asking questions, when I might be brought before the elders of the church to be put on trial about who I was. But upon Jan's death, I became abundantly aware of what rights I did not have. Abundantly aware that it was not going to be me who was going to plan the funeral. That as the highway patrolman came up to me at the scene and asked me who were her next of kin, I could not say it was I that was her spouse. That it was I who was a new widow. If I were to do that, my livelihood would be in danger, and I had a daughter to raise. And so I was silent, watching all of these things happen that were out of my control, out of many people's control in our culture today. And as a person who believes that justice seeking is a part of our spirituality, I struggled with how to speak because my denomination had effectively silenced me. I still had to get up every morning, aware that I had no community of faith to surround me at my time of grief and sorrow. I couldn't tell them what had just happened in my life. I would lose my work, I would lose my identity. And so I would cry as I drove to my church, and I would clean up my face, and I would listen to other people's pain and sorrow and try to offer hope. And then I would cry coming home. I think the moment when I became most clearly aware at how at a visceral level I had internalized the meta message that you are worth less in this culture, that comes from all these experiences of rights that we don't have, of fears, of loss, of our livelihood, was when I began to have questions going through my own mind. The questions were, was that relationship what I really thought it was? Was I really her spouse? Is this really my home that her family are now ripping from me? And my daughter? Or should I just hand over the keys because it was never really mine? And that's when I stopped. And I went inside. And I asked myself, why are you asking this question? And the answer became obvious. Because you have internalized your own oppression. That is the result of being told who you are and who you are not over and over again. And I realized that as long as I stayed in that position, less than, I could not live my life authentically, and I could not speak to the justice issue that this is from a place of being ordained. Because the moment I spoke it, I could be put on trial, as we just completed a trial this last Friday of a woman, Amy DeLong, in Wisconsin, to be shamed in that way. A shame that is not mine, was not hers, would stay with one for a long time. I knew that. But it was 2005, and I had no idea how I would make this change happen in my life. And it was not until 2008 when I had a friend that handed me an article from the Kansas City Star, and the top of that article said, extraordinary ordination in a Methodist tradition. And the subtitle was, without a closet. And I couldn't imagine what this was or who these people were that were planning this extraordinary ordination to take place in Baltimore. And it didn't take me very long connecting to my heart to know that I had to go. I needed to go see what this was and who were these people, because it sounded like hope to me. Turns out it was hope. It was the message I needed to hear. Because when I sat in that congregation and with those people who had made this decision to stand up and commit ecclesiastical disobedience, I heard a message that came not only to the two women who were ordained that day and called to ministry, I heard the words in my heart, "You are of sacred worth. You too belong here. You too have a place at the table." And it wasn't just me and those women. There were hundreds of people there. There were people who had gone through seminary and who had left because the church wasn't ready for them yet. There are people coming up in the church schools today who need to know that there is a place for them in the congregation, at the head of the table, or wherever they're called to be. And so I went before my board of ministry just this last October. The board are the people who are the gatekeepers of who can be ordained. I had served on that very board for 10 years myself. Many of my colleagues that I graduated seminary with were there. And I went there with one intent, to get my voice back, to be able to tell my story, to hold my head up and be who I was called to be. And so I went before them and I told them that I was lesbian and that because of that I had lost my voice and that very many people who were living as closeted clergy had lost theirs too. Fact of the matter is, my daughter said to me when I agonized over this, "I don't know why you want someone that doesn't want you." She didn't get the part about this was my church. It was a big thing to give up, but it was a huge thing to be delivered into my own self, to my own authenticity, to my own voice. And I told those people there that I could not be without my voice any longer, that my story was important, and that the stories of the closeted people need to be told so that we understand the harm we do to others. And I took bread, the symbol of community, and I broke bread, bread that my friend Diane had gone down to Wheatfields to purchase just for that very purpose. Thank you for being part of that. And I broke the bread, and I said to those pastors around that table, some 40 people, "You know, the good teacher kept drawing the circle wider and wider, bringing in from the margins of society people into the center. Lepers, people called sinners, people who were ritually unclean, people who had a certain sexual taboo. And Jesus kept bringing them in. But right now, the United Methodist Church is drawing a diagonal line through that. And I will not stand under that line. I turn in my credentials that I might have my voice again and be empowered." You know, laws and prescriptions, pronouncements, such as the state of Kansas did in what, 2006 or 5, I don't remember, the No Marriage Act. Those are not about categories. Those are about individual people. People with lives like yours and mine. People who deserve to be counted. People all of sacred worth. May it soon be so.